Welcome, subscribers. We are joined by Michael Tesserion, and I'm very glad that Michael wanted to join us today to continue on an offshoot, I guess, on the theme of our latest regular show that we did on children and the outsider. I recently watched Douglas Rushkoff's PBS documentary called The Merchants of Cool, and I'd like to kind of connect this with Michael's webstream and, of course, Origins and Oracles DVD entitled The Subversive Use of Sacred Symbolism in the Media. And there's a lot to say about it, of course, but first off, I suggest everyone, you know, to take a look at Michael's webstream, or even better, get his Subversive DVD through originsandoracles.com. And of course, also watch Rushkoff's PBS documentary. And one thing I think that becomes very clear after watching these two is that there is an incredible assault taking place on children, and especially teenagers, and on the young adults. There is an incredible amount of effort, time, and money that goes into researching teenagers and peer into their personal lives and trace and track their behavior on what's hot and what's not and so forth. But apparently, for the simple reason that the teenager is one of the largest markets out there today. To me, this seems more like owning and breeding and shaping, I guess, your own resource, if you will. It's about molding everyone into this kind of new man, the corporate man of the new world order, a total drone of the system. And it seems like the takeover, it seems, is happening now, and it's a war on the minds and on the personalities of the children and the teenagers. And Michael, I guess that this is one of the main reasons why you find it so incredibly important and, you know, dedicate an entire DVD on this subject.
Yes, and it's very strange because that particular, you know, there's, I think, six programs in the Origins and Oracles series, and The Subversive Use of Sacred Symbolism is the bestseller.
It is, oh.
Yeah, I don't, you know, push them or advertise them.
Yeah.
So I just watch what happens, and, you know, I mean, I think they're all interesting.
Yeah,
and just
definitely.
Purely, you know, purely just watching what people are into, you know, this one seems to just be flying out the door.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad for that, because this has always been a beloved subject of mine.
Yeah.
You know, I've been studying it since the late 70s, early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly the occult aspects, because it's not a criticism of Douglas Rushkoff's movie at all, because, of course, I'm very familiar with the kind of anti-advertising shows that are being made, and I really support them.
Yeah.
However, the one thing that I do is go into the occult aspects of it and some of the subliminal aspects. So whenever I watch shows like that, I'm so grateful to see them. I just wish they'd go a little bit deeper, you know, and maybe even explore like the subliminal aspects and certainly the occult aspects. But I think that's coming. I think that down the line, as this, you know, particular what I call psychic tyranny gets worse, and as this corporate man that you're talking about, you know, as this robotoid, you know, programmed child, the destruction of youth continues, maybe then we'll start to see that it's not just a matter of corporations wanting to sell their products.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very severe, you know, and sick form of psychic dictatorship that is being advertised back to us as merely advertising. So there's several levels to this. One of the big advertising scams that they use is just to make us believe that this is just about advertising and marketing.
Yeah.
And in a way, even Rushkoff's, you know, show does not get the solutions at all. It doesn't really get into what is really going on. It's just keeping you within the framework of, you know, this is a problem of advertising. And look, if we could just get in there with our mops and buckets into Madison Avenue and clean up the act a little bit, you know, and kind of, you know, tone down some of the worst aspects of what these marketers are doing, you know, maybe it'll be okay. It's just sort of good ideas of advertising going over the top.
Yeah.
You know, and I do not subscribe to this at all. I do not think it's just a matter of, you know, cleaning it up or advertising getting out of control. You know, I believe, like we were saying on the show there with children and the outsider, that this is a very, very concentrated, deliberate attack upon the future, attack on children, on their natural intelligence and so on. But, you know, I don't know if others feel like this, but very much from a personal, you know, I can make a very personal statement here, is that when I actually see or listen to the tone of voice of these marketers, people like, you know, this DD, whatever her name was on that show.
Yeah, DD, yeah.
I hope you have a link to Rushkoff's show that people can really study this.
Yeah.
Because it's extremely important that they understand what is going on here. But when I just listen to the tone of voice of these marketing people and even look at them, I want to puke. You know, and I'm constantly reminded of, you know, Bill Hicks's skit on advertising, you know, the late comedian.
Sure, sure.
Where he's literally begging these people to go and shoot themselves and commit suicide, rid us of their pestilence, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, this is, to me, I believe that the, well, I would say that the, even the countdown to 2012, where we're heading as a future, you know, is vastly predicated upon advertising and the media and what they happen to do. It's not distinct from that. It's going to be very much, because to me, these people are literally, you know, as Bill Hicks was saying, the spawn of Satan. You know, I mean, they're literally a form of, they indulge in a form of vampirism. It's like a collective form of vampirism.
Yeah.
Only they're sucking innocence. They're sucking purity and they're sucking truth.
Yeah.
And they're sucking it from the youngest generation who have more of that kind of reservoir of natural intelligence and ancestral knowledge. So the cosmic vampire, you know, is basically sucking it through them, through this medium that we call media.
Yeah.
And if people get onto Wikipedia or they, you know, I can give them all the information that's on my DVD. If they get into the history of what the Medes is and where the word mechanic comes from, and where the word medication comes from, and where the word mediation comes from, and this word the medics, who are the Medes? Who are the medics? You know, and what's their game?
Yeah.
People can have a very big awakening into a whole occult thing that's been going on.
Yeah, I'm very glad you brought that up, because that was kind of my, one of the points I wanted to get to, you know, that it's so easy always to blame this only on greed and hungry capitalists, basically. And but as you say, we can stretch this further into so many levels. And on one sense, it almost seems to me like the most grand conspiracy, in a sense, is like the system itself. As you say, many of these marketeers sitting there are, I mean, totally disconnected, no idea of the consequences of what they're doing or anything. But let's not forget, you know, that these people, again, are educated themselves and have gone to these, as you say, you know, the universities, and they have the background, and I guess in one sense are equally under the spell or the mind control. Do you agree on that?
Yeah, I would agree with all of those. I see John Crick Falusi, the, you know, the creator of the Ren and Stimpy show, this is a very popular show on American TV. He literally said, quote, "I think we are destroying the minds of Americans, and that has been one of my lifelong ambitions."
Yeah.
So we actually have creatures out there. We have species. We have a species of Fabian left-wing agent provocateurs who've been brought in, you know, by the Masonic Order to found these corporations. You know, David Ogilvy, one of the, you know, marketers, get onto the encyclopedias and look into the name Ogilvy and find out the history of that name and where it comes from, and discover that the Tudor dynasty, one of the supreme, you know, henchmen at the time of Queen Elizabeth I, the Tudor dynasty, behind the pirates, behind the creation of the first military intelligence, was Ogilvy. You'll find that it's an Ogilvy today who was the head of forestry that's in charge of going around most of Europe and certainly most of Britain, cutting down all the oak trees. You're going to find out, you know, that these people are connected to the Cecils, that they're connected to the, you know, Francis Bacons. And these people are not just, you know, they just show up in an American milieu as if they're Americans, you know, working on America. But you have to understand, these people are agents of the royal dynasties. Their symbolism shows you that. You know, is it an accident that in Douglas Rushkoff's show there, we have one of the marketing groups called Cornerstone Group?
Yeah, exactly.
Is it an accident that we see doves in the graphics for the Howard Stern show? Why of all the different millions of symbols that you could use, why did Howard Stern pick, or whoever designed that logo, the white dove, which we know not only connects to the Holy Spirit, you know, but also to Scorpio and the spirit of rebellion and so many other things, and also to the Knights of Columbus, you see? Why would Crick Falusi, you know, and others make these kinds of statements? Why would advertisers be so ruthless? Why would they have they not only have million-dollar advertising businesses, they have million-dollar think tank businesses behind those businesses, and then they've got million-dollar monitoring businesses to monitor the effects of advertising, run by the same groups.
Exactly.
You know, Vance Packard, who's one of the first American geniuses, and I mention all the people in my DVD who are people should read and people should study, I have the whole sources, because, you know, Vance Packard back in the 1950s, let it be known that Madison Avenue and these advertising agencies have at least 50 top-level, you know, Freudian psychologists on staff, and many others that they have that they can be called upon. And that whenever any kind of advertisement is finally, you know, being made that's before they launch it to the television, there's a theater, an auditorium filled with their paid experts.
Yeah.
To sit down and critique every single macro minute of that advertisement, you know, from an aesthetic point of view, from colors, from tone, from all sorts of, you know, cinematic and subliminal points of view. So we have an army of psychology here that knows you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like I've been telling the kids, you know, you are being studied. It's time for you to study the people who are manipulating you. It's time for you to get to know who these people are because they know every aspect of your libido.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you know, can we connect this also, I guess, with, Edward Bernays, apparently Freud's nephew, who...
Well, the connections are made, but, you know, I don't like to tie them up because Freud was a humanitarian and Edward Bernays was certainly not. And Edward Bernays, obviously, by being part of the Freud family, you know, manipulated and took the teachings of Freud about the human spirit.
Mm, yeah.
And, you know, and used him for his own vile purposes, probably being an agent of the Tavistock Institute, because, you know, Freud for a while himself was, you know, when he moved to England, you see, he lived not far from Tavistock.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, the Tavistock people were probably down on him every day there, you know, trying to pick his brain and find out and have him come and consult.
Yeah.
And he was dying at the time. He was a very old man at the time, and I believe he'd actually been poisoned. I believe it's Sigmund Freud. And we have the proof of this. The proof was first brought out by Gerald O'Farrell in a book called The Tutankhamun Deception. You know, we don't want to get into it on this show, but, you know, the fact is that Freud was dying of poisoning at the time. So Bernays, you know, obviously realized this was his forte, a slant that he could get into.
Sure.
And through the Tavistock Institute and through, you know, the through Theodore Adorno and the whole of the Frankfurt School and through the Fabians, these are the people who started to work in New York. And but they use Freudianism.
Yeah, exactly.
But that can't go back to Freud in the same way that you can't say that Blavatsky, you know, just because the Theosophical Society is now, a linchpin or, you know, a sort of a tentacle of the secret societies,
sure.
You can't lay that at the door of Madame Blavatsky.
Exactly.
At least I don't.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's in the same situation in which you can't say, Freud studied the mind, therefore he's responsible for advertising.
Exactly, yeah.
Quite the contrary, the man wrote America off as one of the sickest, you know, places on the face of the earth.
Yeah.
No, and it was totally warning. In fact, you see, one of the biggest quandaries, we were talking in the previous show about the APA, the American Psychiatric Association.
Yeah, yeah.
And its twisting and skewing of anything to do with Freud. Did you know that one of the most major problems that followed Freud in his life was the deliberate mistranslation of every book he wrote?
Really?
Yeah, from the titles on. And this is Bruno Bettelheim. I mean, you have one of the greatest psychologists who ever lived. And one of the greatest writers on sociology and psychology mentioning this. So it's not just Michael Tassarian saying this. Bruno Bettelheim, one of the greatest scholars in America, a friend of Freud, and many other Freudians used to keep on writing back to Freud in Germany saying, do you know that the APA are deliberately misinterpreting your book so as to leave the spiritual qualities out of it? That, you know, because in German, certain words like the id and certain words that you might use, and including the titles of Freud's book, have a very sort of mystical spiritual underpinning. But they were purposely translated so that that would all be played down so that the Freudian man would be a much more mechanical individual than, in fact, Freud wanted him to be.
My God.
So, we're dealing with some deliberate mistranslations, realizing that if people were to really understand and read in German or read in English, the true tonality, the true context that Freud was talking about with the mechanics of the mind and the tripart system and the connection to the soul, people would, you know, start to understand the workings of the soul. So they actually mistranslated and very much excised this sort of spiritual component that is implicit in Freud's original works.
Yeah. So again, we have a case of severe misrepresentation and I guess association with the name and so forth, because, I mean, on some level, I remember, you know, going through the teenage years, and, you know, names like Freud and Jung and so forth was kind of associated with this, kind of basically mad people or whatever. I mean, you didn't want to go there because if you had this background of the schooling and this ideas behind it. So, I mean, again, it took some while among other, you know, people like you to enlighten us in regards to their true work and what they really did. So, I mean, this is incredibly important, I think.
Well, once a man is dead or once a man is in old age, he doesn't have the energy to be fighting these lunatics. You know, so it's very easy to take a person's work. Just like you can reproduce a painting. People know that, you know, all sorts of porcelain is replicated, all sorts of pictures are, you know, people have reproductions in their houses of all sorts of famous paintings. I mean, it's accepted that you can, you know, drink from glasses that are fake crystal, you know, and all sorts of things. Wait a minute. Do you not know that that also happens with the words of great men, that their philosophies, their teachings by these, you know, editors and translators? You just see on a book, translated by. But you don't think, wait a minute, who does this guy work for? Who paid his bills? You know, what was his agenda? Why are there so many translations of a particular book? So when it comes to Roscoff's show, for instance, did you notice, for instance, that even though it should have been, you never once heard the word rebel in the whole show? As they're talking about children, and they keep talking about, you know, the MOOC, and they're talking about the guy who stands out, and the media, the advertisers go after the kind of the, they go after the kid who is, you know, sort of self-possessed and a little bit different, but they always avoid the word rebel.
Yeah, that's true.
And yet, that's what the whole show is really based about, is the hunger to grab the rebellious kid so that they can make him a model for those who are not rebels. So it's just a curious oversight that neither Rushkoff nor any of the other, certainly not the marketing people, ever even dropped the word rebel, and yet you'd expect that that would be a very, you know, and that, that ties into my whole underpinning philosophy of advertising, which is that it's to excise the rebel, it's to totally iron out. It's a very elaborate and carefully designed, circuitous method to destroy the spirit of rebellion in the world.
Yes, exactly. Because one of the kind of main ideas that they did express in that documentary was kind of the idea, you know, that this was about first and foremost pinpointing the kids, as you say, who are kind of the have this rebel idea within themselves and kind of the leaders of the group, as I said, and so forth. And then it's about taking that into the mainstream, so other people can, you know, go into that and so forth, and that becomes the hero model. And then, but as soon as that ideal goes mainstream, it's out of the picture for the popular kids. So it's something that feeds on itself and actually destroys itself eventually, I think.
Right, and that is what they're doing there, is subtly trying to tell you that the advertisers are doing nothing. They're just responding to what happens naturally within the milieu of the children. And this is the secret of the lie. This is a completely false piece of information. Actually, the media sell their imagery to the kids because they know they have ubiquitous television, which is already the friend of most children. You know, and so and it's passive because you can just sit in front of it and it does it all for you. So they know fine rightly that through the unbelievable ubiquitous advertising of billboards and movies and television and data space and all the brand logos, they know full well that there's a total psychic dictatorship going on. They also know that, you know, it's, I think 8% of the information of a particular commercial is registered by the conscious mind. 92% goes into the unconscious mind, and it's designed to do that. So they know that the child is merely responding to the rubbish that they put out. But then they look for the one who maybe shows them a modicum of resistance. Somebody who, you know, maybe is not fully free from that system, because of course if you were fully free they wouldn't also be interested in you. This is also the lie. But they look for the teen who's still strong enough to kind of keep his head above the water of all of that lie. And then they come and headhunt that kid. You know, because he's the one. What does a vampire look for? The vampire doesn't look for already drained individuals. He looks for the one who's got blood, who's got spirit. So they're literally telling you in subliminal methodology, if you translate what these people are talking about in that show, into philosophical and spiritual language, they're basically telling you, we're not interested in all the gooks who sit home and are already drained and apathetic. We're interested in the ones who stand out, meaning the rebel, even though they don't use that word, because they're the ones that will feed our ugly, filthy, vile machine. You know, it's a very important, in the very first part of the show, in the very first segment, there's a tremendous word that, you know, just jumped out, and it's guilt money.
Remember
that? When they're talking about the $50 billion that parents, you know, spend to pacify their children, and how this guilt of the working, typical working middle class, you know, family, feel guilty about not spending any time with the children they have given birth to. So, and of course, the guilt of handing them over to the system to be the father and the mother. Well, this is a direct throwback to all our previous shows about the guilt complex, where it's another tentacle. Because remember, we talked about the tree of guilt and the inauthentic life.
Sure, sure.
What we got to understand is that, look, every branch on that tree sprouts other twigs.
Yeah.
And this problem of teens and their, you know, sorry state and their connection to the media is one of those ugly twigs that's growing off the guilt complex, where parents feel a social guilt. Number one, it goes back to they feel they're guilty, period, because they have lived an inauthentic life, having children they can't even spend time with.
Exactly.
That's a loathsome crime, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
So it goes back to their own inauthenticity, that they're having children as their own crutches. They're having children to regain their own sense of youth. They're having children so that they can have a fake sense of responsibility. Hmm. And then they're having children that they can't look after, and then hand over to the system, say, the system and the television and the media will take care of you.
Yeah.
And then to pacify the kid, because now you've been handed over to Lucifer, they give them all this freedom and all of this money. It's a false freedom and it's a false panacea. Remember we talked in previous shows about one of the key aspects of the guilt complex is the embellishment of the halls of the lie?
Yeah, yeah.
The decoration of the rotten citadel. Now you've created this horrible mansion, prison, mm-hmm. that your kids have to live in, or you have to live in, and then the basic idea is, how do we decorate it? Everything you're seeing in Rushkoff's show there, everything that constitutes advertising and the whole, you know, the whole material, corporate, consumeristic lie is nothing but the embellishment of the inauthentic life. That's what we're seeing there. But I just want people to be very conscious that when they see this guilt, to remember our previous shows and realize it is a very key piece in this, because if you hand your children over to the system, to the bank, they even have one advertiser, they're going, oh, we can take it to the bank.
Exactly, yeah.
It's money in the bank.
Oh, you know,
what is the bank? The bank is the system. The bank is the beast. The bank is the corporate, you know, system that thinks of your child as a total zombie, but also as a cash cow.
Exactly.
And it is your guilt. It is, again, it goes back to the inauthentic life of people that are committed to the lie themselves, 100% wall-to-wall committed to the lie, and then they're handing their children over, not to shaman, not to wizards, not to mystics, not to, you know, philosophers, not to, you know, even sending to Steiner School or to, you know, the Krishnamurti School, anything that would try to bring out their individuality. No, you're handing them over to the beast to do with as you will.
Yeah.
In the same way the voodoo doctor dresses a voodoo doll. Now the media can dress your child in whatever corporate logos it wants. It can stick as many pins into it as it wants. Hmm. It can pull as many strings as it wants because you handed your child over to the witch doctor.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah, and I totally agree. I mean, it's crazy. And one thing that kind of got to me was the last time we talked, you mentioned oppositional defiance disorder, the odd, and in a sense, this is also the same very behavior that kind of, I guess, you know, we could connect with this Mook character, the totally off the wall crazy dude, the Tom Green type character, and on one level, then this is encouraged in the media in that sense, and then it's, I guess, the remedies for that is kind of in the school world or the adult world is the medication of the child, basically.
That's right. The Mook is, you know, they said in the show, cruel, loud, and obnoxious.
Yeah.
Right, you handed your kid over, and now they're going to drag him down to a lower level than the rebel. See, they want to make a mirror image of the true rebel who's healthy, who's taking care of himself, who's aware, who's sharp, who's educated and intelligent and proactive and natural. They're going to create this obnoxious harlequin, this utterly, you know, patchwork creation, who is of the lowest chakra possible. You know, I keep saying, and of course MTV is the, you know, organization very much behind this, and I've stressed in my DVD that MTV is just a play on the word empty.
Yeah.
The emptying out of the ancestral reservoir. First of all, it has to make television a friend, you know, something that a child can rely on. And did you notice in this clip where the MTV creatures were going in there, the marketing creatures were going in to talk to the kids, and they were paying the kids at this particular... session.
Yeah, sure.
The very beginning. Did you notice that the teens actually don't respond, even to them? Even though you paid them, they're not really interested in responding.
Exactly, yeah.
Now that shows that later on they're trying to tell you, oh, we just go with what the teens are saying. Well, as a matter of fact, no, you don't, because the teens see you as a bunch of shysters.
Yeah.
And they don't actually necessarily respond. You got to coerce them to respond. So the kids is almost seduced It's a seduction that's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And did you notice, for instance, when the two MTV guys went into the room of the MOOC that they were, you know, prospective MOOC? They immediately, the both of them sat down on the floor, way lower than the young teenager guy. You know, they didn't even sit on the chairs that he had provided.
Yeah, yeah.
Two of them get on the floor. Look at the they even come in using subliminals. That they know, in order to get this guy's confidence, we will practically lie on his carpet.
Yeah.
Because then he'll have a subliminal feeling that he's the one in charge.
Yeah.
So these two corporate executives are lounging on his floor when there's chairs sitting there. All subliminal to go, you're above us. We're so interested in what you got to say, Bob,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Let us know what you're all about.
Yeah.
And all the time, you know, they're sucking this kid's energy. It's
sure.
Like,
yeah.
Absolutely using this kind of, you know, Tavistock type of... So when people are claiming, hey, it's Freudian, they better find out. You better be very specific about the kind of organizations that are behind this. You know, start researching the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations, you see, and the Frankfurt School, and, you know, which I go into in my DVD, find out from these sources who exactly is behind this kind of thing.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
and the kind of methodologies that these experts are using, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, MTV, you know, they got smart. They realized, remember it was saying that the kids, they knew weren't responding, so they went all the way into almost like saying, the kids have taken over. We're giving them the camera. We're giving them the, you know, they're giving us the direction.
Yeah, yeah.
This whole cult of spending millions on advertising to do what? To prove that advertising doesn't do anything. You know, and people fall for it.
Yeah.
Oh, we're not doing anything. We're just listening. We care about your children. You've left them at home alone.
Yeah.
We're the ones going in there and we care about them, you know.
And also, I guess, at this point, this entire system, this machine that it has become now is self-perpetuating in
yeah.
a sense. So it's you don't have to do anything about it, basically, because now it's, you know, the wheels are in motion and nothing's going to stop it. It's going to...
You know, because once you've co-opted the spiritual rebellious instinct of the child, they will push the wheel for you from now on. It's the carrot and the stick.
Yeah.
I call it a safari of the soul. Do you remember the old safaris? A bunch of, you know, tourists dress up like, you know, they're big lion killers, and then they go out with all these guns, and they go out into the middle of the wilderness, Kenya or whatever, to shoot beautiful, magnificent animals so that they can stick their heads on the wall.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what we have with advertising. But the safari that they are going on, that these so-called experts and PR men, they are running around trapping. They don't trap with guns. They don't trap with nets. They trap with ideas and with smiles.
Yeah.
You know, and with money. And and they're trapping the soul. They're trapping the spirit of the teenager.
Yeah.
Which is the only thing left in this planet that has even a modicum of rebellion of spirit. Everybody else is ironed out completely. So the only way that you really have this, you know, spirit of rebellion in any kind of obvious way. Of course, it's in a lot of other people in a non-obvious way, but it's obvious in the teens and the young people.
Yeah, certainly. And I guess now we have, you know, okay, this has been going on for a long while, of course, but now we have, I guess, entire lives, you know, being lived within this mold. I mean, all drives, all urges, you know, the needs and the wishes and even the ambitions of people are, you know, kind of this within this corporate model, you know, life is totally managed from a source that is, you know, totally outside of yourself and has nothing to do with, you know, who you are or where you're going with your life, because it's, you know, all your dreams are prepackaged and being ready to be sold to you, back to you, basically.
That's right.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, we're living in Bush world, in which evangelist Christianity is meant to be back in town. A moral sensibility. The Christians are back. And yet, where do you hear? At the same time as the so-called moral voice is back, we have this unbelievable decadence of materialistic commercialism rampant. More malls, more Walmarts, less private businesses.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't you think that, you know, I mean, obviously there's a few, you know, what you would call, you know, there's a few exceptions. There's a Christian guy who wrote a book called Marketing Evil. You know, we can look on Amazon for that book, Marketing Evil. I can't remember exactly the author's name right now without looking it up. But, you know, there's one or two, you know, brief exceptions. But on the whole, you'd think that with the rising, you know, of all of this sort of conservative voice, that one of the first things they'd be targeting is the advertisers. No, they've got where they are because of advertising.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And the reason to answer your question is that, you see, why it is so freewheeling now is because they've insinuated themselves. Remember, if you go on safari, if you're having a safari, one of the key things how you trap the tiger or you trap this elephant is by using camouflage.
Mm, yeah.
So MTV were really good at it, but, you know, as they said in the Sprite commercials, the, you know, the Sprite company, they're very good at this camouflaging because they pretend to be with the kids. They pretend to be just as cool as the kids. They hire, you know, bands and kids that dress up to look like the average kid. It's very important for you to be not seen as the enemy.
Yeah.
Well, in religious terms, that's the Judas syndrome. Isn't it? Right?
Yeah.
When somebody appears to be part of you.
Sure, sure.
And comes up and betrays you. Instead of stabbing you in the back, they betray you with a kiss.
Yeah.
And now you want to take that further. It's the full-blown Lucifer syndrome.
Yeah.
The they call it smuggling in their message. But look at even the terminology. You know, the smugglers and the skull and crossbones, perhaps.
Mm.
You see, so there's a whole surreptitious methodology and industry here by which they work. And I will never stop saying it, that it's not about co-opting the rebellion of the child, it's about suppressing the rebellion. It's a very clever way to stop their natural expression.
Yeah.
Because they know that if you have a culture, and the 60s taught them this, the time that David Ogilvy grew up, you know, and started working in Madison Avenue, he was right there on scene in the 60s to see just how society can change overnight.
Yeah.
Between this very conservative 50s generation and then suddenly this big questioning of every aspect of reality. Do you think that Madison Avenue didn't notice this?
Yeah.
Of course they did. And they realized, and their government backers also realized that, listen, we can have worldwide rebellion if these kids grow up to not be regressed. So your job is to help them, you know, repress them, their own rebellion, to cause worldwide regression. And to do it through this symbolic tyranny.
Yeah.
Just like Paul Levy was talking about, you know, diabolic is to split and divide, symbolic is to bring together.
Yeah, yeah.
So unless we have our symbolic, you know, communicative pattern recognition skills working overnight, we are going to be subject then to this. Because, as I said before, and Gene Kilbourn said it, that 8% of any particular message in advertising is registered, and 82% is not registered. So the person who has not got symbolic literacy is absolutely the darling of the advertising industry. He's going to be completely ruined.
Yeah, yeah. And
but the MOOC, though, very important to understand, though, that you see, the MOOC is the simulated version of the rebel.
Exactly, yeah.
They got to hand you it back. They drain it, they inviscerate it, they gut it, the real rebellion, and then they hand you back the simulated, analog version, which is the MOOC. Which is the rap generation, which is the hip-hop generation.
Yeah.
There's no rebels there. There's no rebels at Burning Man. There's no rebels at any of this stuff. There's no rebels, you know, Chris Bernstein and, you know, Rick Rubin and all these treacherous pawns of the government, you know, who opened these record companies. None of those people incited true, healthy rebellion. They were on lookout for the rebels to suppress it by handing them million-dollar record deals and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So that even now, Chris Rock and other people are saying, don't upset the system. Obey the law.
Yeah.
You know, have you ever listened to any of the latest stuff that Chris Rock's been coming out with?
No,
it's all subliminally, you know, system, pro-system, pro-system. Yeah, because he's part of the system now. They've bought him off.
Yeah, and that piece is actually quite good in the Rushkoff documentary about the Limp Bizkit, and also, of course, that they end on. I can't remember the band, Clown Maniacs or something like that.
Yeah, the Clown Posse.
That might be it, yeah, sure, yeah. I mean, totally bought off and all of that, and
that's
being
right.
Sold back to them again as the true rebels, as you say. I mean, and this is an art form. It's it's a science maybe. And also one thing that's quite interesting that you also have been speaking about, this kind of this, I guess we could call it religious themes, or kind of the esoteric symbolism.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the connected with products and so forth, the use of, you know, light and all of this. And
that's right. The cross, all the different symbolism coming out of the ancient world.
Yeah.
This is connected more, though, to the occult side of it.
Mm.
People need to become very familiar with that. So my DVD is very much for those people who are interested in the real deep underpinnings of how the mind works, how the Tavistock Institute and see these individuals in Madison Avenue really work with co-opting your zeal for the sacred. You know, in the two articles that I also wrote that people can come onto the Taroscope's website and go and read, it very much show there that man's development spiritually would normally be very open and easy. It's just that you have impediments being put in front of your spiritual development. Mm-hmm. It's not you, but then of course you blame yourself, going, "Oh, I can't do this. I can't concentrate. I must be weak. I must be immoral." Mm-hmm. See, they've got you trained into auto interjecting, you know, your own problems instead of realizing they've created all these impediments for you. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But one thing I do go into in my DVD is that this whole get them when they're young concept and mm-hmm. the reasons for that.
Yeah.
Very briefly, I can just say it has to do with the pleasure principle. When a child is born, they're not in what is called the reality principle, they're in the pleasure principle. And the pleasure principle is, you know, is generally an immoral place. Like all children are amoral, they don't have any moral sensibility.
Yeah.
And they have what's called instant gratification. Later on, as the child grows, we have what's called the reality principle, which shows a child that, you know, basically you have to postpone gratification in order to live in society and get what you want. You can get what you want, but you have to sort of go through a lot of lengthy processes to get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't rape all the women you want, so you have to marry and rape one. Right? That kind of concept.
Yeah,
I'm being
yeah.
gratuitous about it, but that's Oof. Basically the idea, is that you can have what you want, but you'll have it as society packages it for, you know, from you,
yeah.
for you.
Yeah.
But see, the advertisers want to jump over the heads of that and go back to the child as early as they can when the echoing influence of the pleasure principle is still very strong. And if they can work at a child's reality, if they can work on a child's pleasure principle, you'll create a society of regressed adults, people who are not in the reality principle anymore,
yeah.
people who do not know what it means to delay gratification and who don't want to do it. Now, this is a way that, remember we were talking in previous shows about, and I talked extensively on the web stream, about the post-human world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And that one of the concepts of 2012 being a time in which, you know, humanity goes through great changes, we're on the countdown to a post-human world here.
Sure,
and the post-human
yeah.
world means an all-out onslaught on the humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
why I say that this advertising is very important, because it's creating a non-human human, a post-human, a person who has no sense of creativity. The creativity that builds civilization in a healthy way is being cut off at the root.
Yeah.
And these artificial personas are being produced for you. You lose your own sense of self with the help of the parents. And like that girl sitting in front of the mirror, remember in the show?
Mm-hmm.
She goes, "I just have to look good for people."
Sure, yeah.
"My whole day is ruined." She's really in tears even talking about it.
Yeah.
"My whole day is ruined if I don't look for good for people."
Hmm.
What's the message that girl is telling you? "I am nothing. I don't mean anything to myself. But I must look good for everybody else."
Yeah. External gratification, external
approval.
You know, yeah, exactly. Approval of yourself through external other people and so forth.
And this was brought out in the 1960s with Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman.
Mm-hmm.
The whole theme of that incredible play, I mean, this is not a new thing here. You know, mm-hmm. almost since the beginning of the creation of America, we're dealing with the loss of a soul.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur Miller's whole Death of a Salesman is with a father, this imbecilic marketing, you know, person who's lived the American lie his whole life, is trying to tell his kids, "Smile and be liked. It's very important for you to be liked. Everything about life is being liked."
Yeah.
He never gave them any of his kids a sense, his two sons, he never gave them a sense of true spirit.
Hmm.
And he was a working class peon, and yet he was telling his kids, you know, bow down to the system, basically smile and be liked. That's the most important thing in life.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing.
And then once you've given them this false persona, then there is the inevitable addiction to the persona. Once you have no selfhood, no core, and you've now, you know, adopted the Benetton look, or, you know, whatever kind of, you know, thing they've handed you,
yeah.
you're addicted to the next. You're like an addict. You need a bigger, you know, kick the next time, the next time, the next time.
Sure, sure. And it's always something to pursue and try to keep up on also, because it's always changing, and you're unsure of if you're onto it or not, and this, you know, might be difficult to decode or whatever. I mean, it must be a nightmare to be in that mindset.
It is. I've seen aspects of it in my own life, you know,
mm-hmm.
and people around me, and of course, since I started studying it,
yeah.
which luckily I did a little early in my life, so I look at that as a very positive thing. I can't even remember what really got me onto it. It was my love of art, you know, and painting, mm-hmm. and then suddenly I got interested in more of the subversive side of it.
Sure.
It's kind of more like my character is. I really can't, you know, put together the dots that actually sort of move me in that direction, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe it was my occult studies. I don't know. It was a combination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, I noticed, for instance, very early on, symbols and logos, like the word Sprite. They keep mentioning the Sprite Corporation.
Sure, sure.
And how Sprite is definitely one of the offenders in sort of co-opting the rebels of the teen rebel spirit. Well, the word Sprite is a play on the word spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what subliminally in that word, spirit, sprite. That's why they come up with that logo and all the symbolism of light that they use. In that, there's so many examples of this that I go into in the DVDs, but that's one of them.
Yeah.
Like Coke and Pepsi and Sprite. Sprite is the word spirit. So when people see these commercials of people drinking in this drink of light, in this clear liquid, this elixir of life, you see, they're subliminally attracted because the spirit that has been raped from them by companies just like Sprite, they hand you back in this surrogate way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've got a quote from Jean Kilburn, if I may read it. She says...
Sure.
She has a book called Can't Buy Me Love, and she says, addiction is the number one health problem in America today. Many people feel that addiction is also the root of other problems such as crime, poverty, divorce, child abuse, and other forms of violence. So she is looking at the addiction thing very deeply, and this is, addiction, as anyone who's really studied it knows, is a healthy thing because addiction is merely trying to replace something that was taken away that was healthy and wholesome. So the roots of addiction is in something positive. You're not addicted to anything unless something that addiction is a replacement for.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's thievery in the night.
Mm.
You know, the whole introduction to the DVD, Subversive Use of Sacred Symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole introduction that I do in the beginning, I go into this whole elaborate thing about how thieves come into your house and steal from you that which is already yours to then sell it back to you, or actually not to sell it back to you, to sell reproductions of it back to you in the daylight.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the real criminality that goes on.
Sure, sure.
And let's make no mistake about it, Henrik, that these advertising companies do not work autonomously. They are connected to government.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so in 1996, for instance, $500 million was spent on the presidential campaign, on the election, by corporations.
Sure.
And by Wall Street and Madison Avenue.
And
so that they're hand in hand, they're joined at the hip with the agents of the system, the agents of propaganda.
Sure, sure. And again, at the same time, they are making billions on the market research that they're doing, and in consequence, you know, they can sell the products on it. And then, I guess, in return also, they, as you say, they get a chance to actually study the human being at the same time and learn all of this stuff that they're actually doing. I would be really interested to know, you know, what happens to all of the data that actually is collected through these, you know, endless market researching, you know.
Well, it keeps going round and round. You see, studying the human psyche, they've got the fundamentals for thousands of years.
Yeah.
This is just a reapplication in a social milieu, and certainly in a Western milieu, you know, and of course it's spreading to the East now. They just reapply it. The Medes, this is based on the knowledge of the Medes. And the Medes were the first psychologists going back thousands of years. There's always been a psychologically aware cult of sorcerers who worked for the royal families of the world.
Sure.
And the royal families of all the kingdoms of the world always used to employ these Medes when they wanted to take out a particular adversary and they couldn't do it through open war. And so the royal dynasties are still very active in the world today. And wherever you have royal dynasties, you have your Merlins and you have your court wizards, you see, who can achieve your goals in a more subliminal way.
Yeah.
Like I said, their symbolism alone shows you it. The red squares, the MTV logo, Sprite, you know, they're basically telling you. If people watch my DVD, they'll come out the other end of that and, you know, they'll know completely and utterly for sure.
Sure.
That you are being told this in plain sight by the advertising logos and the memes and the jingles and certainly the advertising images that are now being placed on. And if you go to the blog and people go to the symbolism section of my blog, there's examples there that have been posted by people on YouTube of the latest rap videos and several commercials.
Sure.
Go in and check out those commercials and, you know, see our analysis of it and start learning about this kind of psychic dictatorship in your midst.
Absolutely.
But just, you know, again, what they didn't really bring out in Rushkoff's, I think he was sensitive to realize that if he went too far, the thing would never get shown.
Yeah, exactly.
But one of the things he should have shown is that they are hand in hand with the government here.
Yeah.
They are propaganda agents, you know, and there's a brilliant book called Techniques of Persuasion that's written by J.A.C. Brown, and he has a quote in there, and he says that propaganda, the word, comes from propagare, and it's in Latin. It's just like this, where we get our word propagate. But in Latin, propagare means the gardener's practice of pinning a fresh shoot of a plant into the earth to reproduce new plants, which take on a life of their own.
Interesting.
So in propaganda, propagare is the cutting of a live piece from a regular plant or tree and then replanting that artificially to, you know, create other plants. So again, it's dependent on the real thing. That is why there's always a subliminal message put in front of you by advertisement of the real thing. Look, Coke even used the term the real thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So they always want to keep in front of you the real father, the real image of the mother, the real image of a good, healthy, utopian, spirit-loving, virtuous state or person.
Mm.
They always want to put in front of you the image of the strong, rebellious teenager. See, they deal with archetypes.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, they're always chipping off that block. They can't allow the real thing to completely vanish.
Hmm.
It's like a vampire that you're constantly sucking his blood, but you'd never suck too much. You make sure that he restores him his own bounty again, so you can continually come back to take bites out of it. So in answer to your question about where this knowledge goes, they're very, very careful, you see, to not completely suck dry society.
Yeah,
they use the knowledge, but they also have enough plug-in to the spiritual aspects of life.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll keep seeing this, especially in the beautiful saintly symbolism that they often use. And I have many, many examples of this on the DVD that people can see.
Yeah.
So they present for you, of course, everyone knows this part, that they present for you the antisocial tendencies.
True.
When you look at Rushkov's show, you see the wrestling. Remember they went into the wrestling
thing?
Sure,
yeah, yeah.
Which is, what is that? That's the processing vicariously of the kid's violence, the kid's terrible self-angst.
Yeah.
The rebel hates the system. They know they're being vampirized. And so they have this unbelievable rebellious urge to just destroy and go out and change society.
Sure, yeah.
But the television carefully puts in front of you some vicarious way. No, no, don't beat up the government. Don't go out and create trouble. Beat yourselves up.
Yeah.
Get into wrestling. It's really cool.
Yeah.
You can crack your own skull, but don't forever think of educating yourself so that you channel this angst, you see, where it really might do damage to the society.
Exactly. Yeah.
Hey, you want to be into heavy metal? Well, we know heavy metal is really rebellious and is also very moral and has a very spiritual message. Well, hell, we'll create our own versions of heavy metal bands.
Yeah.
That are low energy, misogynist, cruel, just hideously low chakra.
Yeah.
You follow those guys. And then, because they're the Pied Pipers, we're gonna give them big record deals and make them millionaires for doing our dirty work.
Exactly. Yeah. It's all there, and it's all, of course, again, your suspicion. I always get a sense of suspicion when these bands who pop out of nowhere, and there is always this mystery, it seems, to how bands succeed and so forth. But again, I mean, it's
there's
all
no
about
mystery, yeah.
Exactly, it's all about just bringing them right to the front. I mean,
see, one of the things that is very much a part of this concept of the discontent that the marketers are using a lot, and of course parents will feel this on a daily basis, is that now that the child has been handed over to the state and the parent is the state, should the real parent deny the child anything that the state is offering, the child can blame the parent.
Hmm.
Right?
Hmm.
Yeah, and that's very, very necessary for a child. The state is promising you can now punish your parent.
Yeah.
Because if your parent says no to you watching TV or dressing in the latest style or going out with these new friends or going to these concerts or doing all of this stuff, we allow you to punish your parent.
Yeah.
With bad behavior, you see, and just total antisocial behavior,
yeah.
Because now they're your enemy. You see how I'm saying that the Tavistock Institute and these people are turning the child mind into an antisocial creature. They can now blame their own parents if those parents, obviously coming from a more moral position, say, oh my God, I can't fund this. I can't give you all this money to go and do this lunatic stuff,
sure,
or buy all this crap.
Sure, sure, yeah.
You know, and I don't see you saying, kids aren't running and go, Mommy, don't buy me all that corporate stuff because, I'm going to want to, you can buy me stuff from these healthy,
yeah,
more organic places, or you're going to buy me stuff that's only from these more consciously aware. The kids are immoral. They don't care about any of that stuff.
Hmm.
I mean, they did when I taught, because I brought this up, and, we made changes on the grassroots level when I taught children. Of course, then when it's in their face, they will make these changes, and they'll make them very radically.
Mm-hmm.
But left to their own devices, they'll drink Coke and Pepsi from morning till night.
Sure, sure, yeah.
And they'll, follow through on all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And the retaliation, the promise is, don't be a rebel towards the system. Be a rebel at home towards your parents. Make their life a hell.
Yeah.
Because as long as you're channeling rebellious, negative, toxic energy to your poor parents who are working all the days, to support you, you are not going out and doing it, basically, to the system that is really is Big Brother.
Hmm.
So it's, again, a fundamental area here.
Certainly. I mean, let the kids, decide over the parents, and we decide over the kids. And again, this returns to the guilt money. What was it? I think teenagers what did I say, managed to, you know, squeeze out a 50 billion or something from the parents.
50 billion. Yeah. 50 billion. And that's just, that was in, when he made that film.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
The quotes that we have in my DVD and the ones that he has on that show, the Merchants of Cool, they're outdated already, Henrik.
Yeah. it's
that
amazing.
Was only the beginning. That's basically the, you know, the beginning of the fad.
Yeah.
Is the figures, you know, it's going to be enormous now because of the power of the child. Taking that rebellion, taking that healthy spirit of rebellion and turning it around is a huge market. And it's going to be something that is key to where we're going, you know, in the future. And I never will stop insisting that this, by conscious design, the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations, through the Council on Foreign Relations, through Madison Avenue, and then down into the life of the merchants.
Yeah.
Who want to sell their products. And of course, yeah, they make billions of dollars. That's right. That does pacify the people who are working for a living, who want to make their companies to be successful. But, you know, I take it up beyond that. We're dealing with an aesthetic psychic dictatorship that's not really the merchant's responsibility. So don't be waving placards in front of, you know, Procter & Gamble like they did in the past, or necessarily blaming the merchant here, because the merchant is a merchant.
Exactly, yeah.
We're talking about an entirely different group of people who are really responsible here, who are using the needs of the merchant for their own pernicious devices. Now, and what is that? Let's understand it fundamentally. It's what I go into in the DVD very strongly. It's the abolition of man. And the abolition of man first starts with the abolition of humanity, of the virtuous man, of the rebellious man. You know, Carl Jung said it. And this quote I'm going to read, you know, let everyone understand how accurate this is, and that this is the poster child. This is the quote that the Madison Avenue brains never, ever forget. And this is what their whole, this is their whole legend. This is their whole philosophy. He says that consciousness is a very recent acquisition of nature, and it is still in an experimental state. It is frail, it is menaced by specific dangers, and is easily injured. As anthropologists have noted, one of the most common mental derangements that occur amongst primitive people is what they might call the loss of a soul. Now, when you, somebody said, I think it was Utah Phillips, she said, the earth is being murdered, not by nameless people, but with people with names and addresses. And I say the same thing about this advertising, you know, corruption. It's not just happening in some vague, amorphous thing that, you know, people can't see. This is a direct psychic dictatorship which has names and addresses and an agenda and a history.
Yeah.
It's to create a post-human world. It's to create unbelievable schizophrenia. And Artie Lang said something about schizophrenics. He said, schizophrenics, whatever else they may be, are people who have tried to respond to other persons' reality too much too early. And they have inextricably been caught up in the games that other people play. Look at this incredible interpretation. R.D. Lang, the great German, the great Scottish psychologist, is literally saying that a schizophrenic has had a no-win situation when he has tried to play in the games created by other people. So the children that are out there in the world today, that's exactly what they've been asked to do from day one.
Yeah.
They've been asked to play in the game of the parents' dynamic, which is tremendously stressful. Then they end up having to identify with these parents just to keep a healthy balance.
Yeah.
Although those identifications could be terribly lethal, psychically and emotionally, and usually are. Then, just as they stabilize to that, and just as they maybe even come out semi-sane from that around about the teenage years, they're now exposed to a greater, more elaborate game of this unbelievable political, sociological identification.
Yeah.
The kids today walking around are in a schizophrenic situation, helping to create a schizogenic society.
Yeah, it's a black hole of devouring itself. You know, one thing, Michael, that I was talking to with Fredrik, my brother, the other day, was to kind of connect all of this, I guess, with the suicide cult. I think you have, in a way, referred to this as the Dionysian cult. You know, we have the Kurt Cobains and the Jim Morrisons and all of this and so forth. I mean,
River Phoenix.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, what's your idea on that? Do you think that they, is this a planned package also to kind of portray these people in that sense as heroes? You know, the ultimate achievement in that sense is, you know, that they died young, basically?
Yeah, the whole die young cult is very much the old, it's a modernization of a very old concept that originally was a very spiritual one, that has been, you know, changed and turned. you can analyze it, if you will, in the same way that R.D. Salinger, who wrote Catcher in the Rye, did, where it's just a matter of the death is that you've died to innocence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they will play upon that. I take it much further and say, no, this is a full-blown cult, like Brian Jones, Jim Morrison, the River Phoenix, the list goes on, Jimi Hendrix. And by the way, did you know that a lot of these people died at exactly the same age?
Hmm, oh really?
Oh yeah. People need to get in and read this book called The Covert War Against Rock by Alex Constantine, the great researcher and investigator, Alex Constantine.
Okay.
On the Taroscope's website, I've got links to his websites, but Alex Constantine is one of the people who was involved in exposing the satanic ritual abuse, you know, very much like the Arizona Wilder.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Kind of cults. He's an American genius who worked a lot, very much like Ted Gunderson, exposing a lot of this kind of thing, and Ted's a personal friend of mine. We worked on all these things for years. Well, he wrote a book called The Covert War Against Rock, and I really recommend people to read that book to find out about the assassinations of Jim Morrison and also Bob Marley, you see. And it's very, very important, as we've been talking here about the whole thing being an act of vampirism. The whole thing that's happening in the social milieu is a satanic rite.
Sure, yeah.
You know, if people watch my Atlantis DVD, they'll be completely aware of what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Well, within that rite, there are many sub-rites. There's many ways to, you know, create the right kind of atmosphere, geomantically, geopathically, subliminally. And one of them is to take out or have killed, you know, the young child. You know, is it really an accident that, the son of Eric Clapton just happened to fall out of a tower block? Is it really an accident that the son of Bruce Lee just happened to up and died one day after making, you know, a particular kind of movie?
The Crow, right?
You see, you know, we can talk to Jack Coetzee here again about the symbolism in a lot of these movies.
One of
our future shows is going to be on some of the symbolism in these movies, you know. So we have a lot of deaths going around us that create a certain ritualistic... Basically, the whole of the youth is dying. The spirit of youth is dying. And so they, occasionally, I believe, they do certain rites in which they will take out physically a certain person who typifies a particular energy, just like the John Lennon assassination and so on. And even in movies where they'll, you know, pictorialize that particular kind of thing happens. There's all sorts of rituals and sub-rituals to tell us what is really going on.
So that we can trace this, I guess, what you're saying, in our modern culture, and people actually get the persona, I guess, of that archetype person or that hero or something like that.
Well, hero worship is basically as old as time. And the idea was based on sympathetic magic. That in order to, if you mimic the actions of the hero, this was what shamanistic culture was all about. Odin went into the underworld, or Odin went and fought, you know, a particular battle. So if you mimic that, or if you exemplify the hero of your culture, you know, Gilgamesh, Hercules, and so on, you will embody aspects of that, those traits of a god. Now, believe me, the people up at Bohemian Grove and the people who run the world, they ain't forgot about any of this. They do this on a absolutely, you know, weekly, monthly level. They're absolutely adherent to the stellar zodiac. This can be proven. My work goes into proving this, that the years, festivals, and rites of which the, you know, Alex Jones revelations or what happens at Bohemian Grove is but one small example. People have revealed what goes on in Skull and Bones Club when the people lie down in the coffin to be born again. I mean, these are just one or two minor, very small examples of a ritualism that goes on all through the year. Part of it based on the old Druidic calendar, the Celtic calendar, things they don't want you to know about because we work by the solar calendar. But these characters work by the lunar and stellar calendar. And they go through all sorts of rites and rituals every day. And many of those rituals involve interacting with the public and involving the public in those rituals. At mass spectacles, which children, you know, like we read the quote last time from Aldous Huxley, about how there would be this programming that it's good for kids to go and be a part of these football games and ice hockey games and even Burning Man, you know. And all you got to do is wave a few spiritual anecdotes and a few, you know, love beads and promise them some drug, you know, infestation, and they'll be all pouring down there. This is the whole idea. And then why are they taken to certain places on the earth that have powerful vortexes like that? Why was the Altamont Festival of the Rolling Stones suddenly debarred from, where they suddenly decide overnight, to the consternation of everybody that was involved in the Altamont, they suddenly won't go to San Francisco, where all the concerts are played, mm-hmm. and they suddenly go miles and miles and miles away into Altamont, out, completely out in the way.
Hmm.
Well, you might want to do that if you're conducting a ritual.
Yeah.
And Bill Graham and all these people are just going, what in the hell do you think you're doing? We organize the concerts. We'll tell you where to go so there can be proper toilets. There can be proper security. There can be proper police presence if need be. Mm-hmm. There can be proper medical people on board. Who are you, Rolling Stones, to just suddenly decide that you want to go to this barren wasteland out there? Well, I would say, hey, man, you got to realize who these guys are and who's backing them and why they'd want to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And let's find out what dates and calendar dates and the position of the moon and all sorts of things that are going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have something going on before our eyes that's not new. It's very, very old. The old idea of the Sun King dying in the water. So Jim Morrison dies in a bathtub of water. Brian Jones dies in a swimming pool full of water. You know, there's a whole symbolism of alchemy and magic that is very much involved in a lot of what these people do because they're initiates of these Dionysian cults. And if anyone should whistleblow on them, like Stanley Kubrick and many others, you see, they'll take them out. They go, it's not your... We didn't allow you to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
Or we allowed you to do it because that was going to be your swan song. Because, you know, that's your last thing you'll ever make.
Yeah.
Because part of the ritual is to let people know, and this is where my work steps in. Part of the ritual that they involve themselves in is to send out what they're doing, encoded messages through the ubiquitous media oracles.
Yeah.
And then people, I've trained myself to be able to notice what how they're doing that, and then hopefully transmit it to other people who understand what the hell is going on. And I find that they are finding out what is going on.
Hmm. And that's what we love to do here, and that's why we enjoy so much to speaking with you, Michael. And again, we're up on the hour here now, and I think that would be a great place to end this. And again, I mean, thank you so much for coming on today and sharing with us your thoughts on this. It's a very important subject, and I'm sure we will, you know, kind of continue on this theme as we move on in our next shows together here. So again, thank you so much, Michael, for coming on the show.
You're most welcome, and you know, we got a 5-hour detailed, you know, presentation there on the Origins and Oracles site.
Yeah.
If you want to follow through on this.
Originsandoracles.com, and you got it's six DVDs in
well,
total.
Well, six programs, but
six
this
programs.
Particular one, the subversive use of sacred symbolism, is the one that I recommend for people to get a thorough working knowledge of the many ways, because this thing is a hydra, like a many-headed hydra, you know. Rushkoff there deals with one aspect of it, which is very important, but there's a whole other, you know. This is a very, very deep and complex labyrinthine type of study, and it's important that, you know, I've tried to do the best work I believe that exists on this subject anywhere in the world.
It's a masterpiece. I really love, you know, the sacred symbolism DVD, and of course people can watch the web stream and then you know, to get the first hints of what you actually are exposing in the what is it, 5-hour, 3-hour long presentation you're doing?
5 hours long, but Brian Hall, a couple of years ago, the Conspiracy Con, gave me the privilege of being able to talk to his audience about this particular psychic tyranny. I really thank him for that. And that's free. That can be got to if they go to my blog. They'll easily be able to find a link through to that particular free web stream that's on Google, you know, or YouTube.
Sure. I will link up these also in correlation to this program so people can find
fantastic.
All
fantastic. Thank you, Henrik.
Thank you so much, Michael. We will speak again soon. Take care, my friend. We'll talk.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for subscribing to Red Eyes Creations. We could not do this without your help and support.
By the way, if anyone here is in advertising or marketing, kill yourself. Just a little thought. I'm just trying to plant seeds. Maybe one day they'll take root. I don't know. You try. You do what you can. Kill yourself. Seriously, though, if you are, do. No, really. There's no rationalization for what you do, and you are Satan's little helpers. Okay? Kill yourself. Seriously. You're the ruiner of all things good. Seriously. No, this is not a joke. It's going to be a joke coming. There's no fucking joke coming. You are Satan's spawn. Filling the world with bile and garbage. You are fucked and you are fucking us. Kill yourself. It's the only way to save your fucking soul. Kill yourself. Plant seeds. I know all the marketing people are going, he's doing a joke. There's no joke here whatsoever. Suck a tailpipe, fucking hang yourself, borrow a gun from a Yank friend. I don't care how you do it. rid the world of your evil fucking machinations. Okay, whatever, you know what I mean. I know what all the marketing people are thinking right now, too. Oh, you know what Bill's doing? He's going for that anti-marketing dollar. That's a good market. He's very smart. Oh, man, I am not doing that, you fucking evil scumbags. Oh, you know what Bill's doing now? He's going for the righteous indignation dollar. That's a big dollar. A lot of people are feeling that indignation. We've done research. Huge market. He's doing a good thing. God damn it, I'm not doing that, you scumbags. Quit putting a goddamn dollar sign on every fucking thing on this planet. Ooh, the anger dollar. Huge. Huge in times of recession. Giant market. Bill's very bright to do that. God, I'm just caught in a fucking web. Ooh, the tracks dollar. Big dollar. Huge dollar. Good market. Look at our research. We see that many people feel trapped. If we play to them and separate them into the trapped dollar... live like that. I bet you sleep like fucking babies at night, don't you? What'd you do tonight, honey? Oh, we made arsenic childhood food now. Good night. Yeah, we just said, you know, is your baby really too loud? You know. Yeah, it'll, you know, the mums will love it, yeah. Sleep like fucking children, don't you? This is your world, isn't it?